Matthew chapter 6, as we continue our study through the book of Matthew and spend some significant time in what I consider to be one of the most significant sections of Jesus' teaching, this Sermon on the Mount, and we're trying our best to see it in light of an overarching theme. So Matthew chapter 6, we come to a chapter. Most of these sections are familiar to people, but they tend to be sections that are detached from the rest of the sermon so that we don't put in the context of the whole message found here in the Sermon on the Mount. And so we're going to try our hardest to do that tonight. This is the passage that talks about prayer and giving and fasting and invites us to consider what the reasons are for which we do those things and what are wrong reasons, reasons that Jesus warns us to make sure that we keep far away from. But before we get there, I want to kind of do one of those previously things with you. This is the last week we'll meet together. We'll have a 2-week break after this for the holidays. And so we won't be able to finish all of the Sermon on the Mount, obviously, tonight. But I want you to know where we've been and how we've got there so that once we come to chapter 6, you'll see why it connects to what Jesus has done previously. If you go back to chapter 5, never forget, as difficult as this sermon is and as challenging it as it is, and if it doesn't rub you the wrong way in at least one place, you're not really listening. As hard as it is, it begins with an explosion of blessing. Blessed, 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 over and over again. Blessed, first off, to the disadvantaged, to the impoverished in spirit, and the mourners, and the meek, who are not considered the powerful in our world, and those who are hungering and thirsting for righteousness, which means that they have not obtained justice in any way. So you have this longing that comes from the disadvantaged. And Jesus says to all of those who aren't getting their fair deserts in this world, blessed, you're blessed. Because God's kingdom is coming and God's kingdom will make all wrongs right. Then you have the second half of the Beatitudes where we begin to focus on qualities that Christ is looking to see in our lives. Blessed are the merciful, the pure in heart, or those who have integrity, the peacemakers, and those who are persecuted for righteousness, those willing to suffer for the sake of doing right. And you begin to see we're dealing with a different class of people now here. These are qualities that you want to have. You don't want to hunger and thirst for righteousness. You don't want to mourn. You don't want to be considered one of the weakest in our society. But you do want to have mercy. You do want to have integrity. You do want to be a peacemaker, and if it demands it of you, you want to stick to those things no matter what the price might be. Well, that begins this explosion of blessing, inviting us as Christ followers to be two significant things: salt of the earth and light of the world in verses 13 and 14. Salt that is a preservative, salt that brings some taste to things, light that sheds light, that brings light in the midst of darkness, so that, verse 16, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. Which brings us to what I consider the main point of the Sermon on the Mount. To me, verses 17 through 20 are the most significant section in this sermon because it's what Jesus is trying to develop. He wants to state where he stands to the law he loves, the law he's inherited, the law of his people. But he says in verse 17, don't think I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill. And that's a key word for Matthew. Jesus is the fulfillment of so many Old Testament prophecies, of all of Israel's longing. And now Jesus says about this thing called the law, which was loved. He says, I haven't come to abolish it, I've come to fulfill it. Which means I'm not doing away with it, but we can't view it in the same way we have in the past either, because now the fulfillment has come, the goal toward which the law was leading, and now that it's embodied in Christ, and he's going to manifest what it means to truly live God's will, God's intention among humankind, we have to understand all of Moses' law in light of that. Which means it still remains, but it must be interpreted and viewed through the lens of Christ's life, which will take the law deeper than perhaps many have taken it before, so that you come to verse 20. This is the key verse. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you'll not enter the kingdom of heaven. This is all about the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. But unless your righteousness surpasses, and he uses the most devout, he doesn't use Pharisees as a caricature, he understands them to be the most devout, God-fearing, serious desires of following law that there is. And he says, you need to have a greater righteousness. And then he gives you six case examples so you can begin to see what he's suggesting when he says a greater righteousness. It's a righteousness in accordance to the law, but it takes the law further. It understands the law in light of what Christ has done. So you have that, these six case studies. You have the one on murder. It's not just you shouldn't murder, but you shouldn't demean others. You shouldn't call them fool. You shouldn't be angry with them. All of those things lead to murder, but all of those things are what's really behind that idea of thou shalt not murder. Just that you don't simply stab someone, but that you don't want to stab someone. That you understand that that could never be God's will to lash out in violence toward another. And in fact, it's more God's will that you look at others with honor and dignity and never call them fools, because he says if you call someone fool, you're in danger of the fire of hell. That even that kind of demeaning is behind that idea of holding others in dignity, not seeing yourself as the judge who can destroy them. And that's what he does with all of these examples. And we looked at those in detail last week. He talks about adultery, relationships and marriage with divorce and remarriage. He talks about oaths and making sure your word has integrity. He talks about an eye for an eye and says we got to go beyond just simply justice, but we've got to move into a realm in which those followers of Christ who proclaim Him and His call actually will help those in ways that go far beyond anything they justly deserve. And then the coup de grace, the one that just really, if it doesn't rub you the wrong way, you're not hearing it right. In verse 43, you've heard it said, love your neighbor, hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. That's how your Father is. Your Father causes the sun to rise on the righteous and on the unrighteous. And so the challenge is to see that there can never be a violent expression of the way of Christ followers, that the call is never, ever to see an enemy and decide that they are unworthy, must be eliminated. The call instead is to pray for them, to seek their good, to try as best as we can to be a people of reconciliation and peace. Blessed are the peacemakers. That's a high call. You can see why we're moving into the realm of a greater righteousness. And it's like that because that's how Jesus was. On the cross, instead of lashing out his enemies, calling them raca, fool, demeaning them, instead of demanding justice and protesting the whole thing, he instead says, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And we begin to see why it is that Jesus is the embodiment of all that God willed in the law and how that does fulfill and transform. It necessarily has to transform our understanding of social practice, our understanding of how we relate to one another, our understanding of what it means to do the will of God in light of the fullness of Christ. That then takes us to this wonderful chapter, chapter 6, where we're introduced to three key spiritual practices. The practices are all those that anyone that has kind of a serious sense of wanting to be a religious person, and perhaps all the religious traditions, has some kind of stake in all of these. The first is almsgiving, the second is prayer, the third is fasting. And he's going to talk about these wonderful marks of spiritually devout people. These are all good things. It's a wonderful thing to give to the poor. It's a wonderful thing to seek God in prayer. It is a wonderful thing to humble yourself in fasting. And yet, Jesus is going to do something quite amazing in this chapter, and he's going to give us a warning about how all of these things can go wrong. And it has to do with the greater righteousness. If we're talking about living in light of the fullness of Christ, in the way that he lived in his Abba spirituality, in the way that he understood who he was in the presence of the Father, then we understand that these spiritual practices cannot just be performances for others' approval or to gain a certain prominence in your community. They have to be so much more than that. They have to then, therefore, be seen in light of the fullness, the greater righteousness that Christ brings. And so let's look at each one of those, and you'll see the warning, by the way, in verse 1. Chapter 6, verse 1. Everyone there? Verse 1 through 18 is what we'll cover tonight. Jesus begins with, be careful, or warning. Don't do your acts of righteousness before others in order to be seen by them. For if you do, you've lost all reward with your Father in heaven. And so that's the overarching warning. And that overarching warning will be applied to all three of these practices. Don't do this for others' applause. Don't do this for others' approval. We are all, at the end of the day, people who are in very many ways approval junkies. We want others' approval, and we usually want it through the means by which our world tells us we're success. We got a lot of money, we got a lot of power, we got a lot of prominence. But when we're talking about the spiritual realm and we want to seek others' approval and endorsement in that realm, then all of a sudden we realize there are certain practices that you can perform that can gain you quite a bit of clout in a religious community. One of them is, boy, what a giver. What a prayer. What a committed person, committed to denying themselves and just going through the most horrendous agony and fasting in order to take God seriously. That all of these have that element, and yet all of them can be perverted to being done for the wrong reason, which then raises the question, what is the right reason? And that's what Jesus wants to get at with these three disciplines here before. So let's begin with the first one. It's almsgiving. It's verses 2 through 4. So here he now is going to develop that. So when you give to the needy, assuming that his followers are going to give to the needy. I mean, he doesn't say you ought to give to the needy. He assumes that his followers are going to give to the needy, that they'll see that as an essential part of their spiritual devotion. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets, to be honored by men or to be seen by others. I tell you the truth, they've received their reward in full. Why have they received their reward in full? Because they did it to be seen. And they were seen. And they have what they were looking for. Others applaud, others approve, and yet that's not supposed to be the reason that one gives alms. And so Jesus says they have their reward because they were seeking to be seen. But when you, verse 3, give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. Then your Father, who sees what's done in secret, will reward you. Now you're going to see that word secret pop up again and again. And I think one of the things we tend to do with secret is we get a bit intimidated and think, oh my gosh, the Father who sees in secret, always there, always observing, this detached observer. But note, when Jesus says, your Father, he's implying that same sense of intimacy and tender care that he has with Father as the Abba. That you have this tender, loving God who is so close to you that in your most private moments, this God is overseeing you, looking over you, watching over you, wanting the best for you, yearning for a deeper relationship, wanting you to grow in faith and hope and love. And so when you give, make sure that it's an audience of one for which you're giving. That you're not doing it so that you can get a plaque somewhere, so you can put your name across something, or that you can be recognized in the community as just a generous, generous person. Make sure your first priority is that you're doing it for the pleasure of God. You're doing it for the sake of the God who gives so generously. That you're seeking to live and walk in the way of the Father, in whose presence you constantly find yourself. And so that's the first thing, almsgiving. And the issue is give without fanfare. Make sure you keep in mind that the point of giving is in order to please God and to show the heart of God. Then he moves to prayer. And this, you'll notice, is where we get our great Lord's Prayer that we pray every Sunday during first service and then at certain times in second service. You'll see that the Lord's Prayer starts in verse 9, and we'll talk about that, but not in detail, because I've done a whole sermon series, one verse a week, one line a week, actually, with that. So we're not going to get too bogged down with that, but let's see the surrounding for it. Verse 5, when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by others. Do you see the common theme? They're praying to be seen. They're not praying to draw closer to God. They're not praying to please God. They're praying to please others. They're praying so that others will say, what a spiritual person this is. What a deeply devout religious person this is. So Jesus says, I tell you the truth, if that's what they were doing this for, they've succeeded. They've won because they received their reward in full, but that's not what the reward for prayer is supposed to be. So verse 6, when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen. Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Again, I just love that language because in secret there is meant to imply this deep, intimate bond, this desire for a closeness that God has for each of God's children. That God desires this intimacy, this ability to pull away all the distortions and all of the troubles of the world and to come away just like you would with your deeply most beloved friend and say what's on your heart. And speak so that you might be heard, that the divine might respond, that you might have the ear of God, who sees what's done in secret and will reward you. So that you're not this, and now he gives kind of a second warning, verse 7, when you pray, don't be babbling like the pagans, for they think they will be heard because of their many words. Which is to say, most of the Gentiles thought if you found the right phrase. We see this in movies like Harry Potter and other things. If you can just get the right phrase down, you can control the elements. You can control the divine. You can control the force or whatever it is you're doing. That you're looking for the right phrase. And if you can't get the right phrase, maybe if you jump up and down and just, you know, make sure that you have as loud a voice as you can, then maybe God might respond. But Jesus wants to suggest you don't have to babble like that because in verse 8, maybe my favorite verse in our section, don't be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask Him. God, who sees you in secret, in whose secret presence we're constantly residing, knows us so intimately that I don't even have to ask, and God knows what I need. However, God loves me so much, God wants me to ask, so that I might develop a relationship of dependence and of love and of trust, so that you'll oftentimes have people say, you know, if God knows in advance what we already need, why do we pray? Well, here's why you pray. Verse 8, don't be like them. Your Father knows what you need before you ask them. Verse 9, this then is how you should pray. So God knows what you need. The point isn't that you're telling God what you need. The point isn't you're trying to make God as loving as you are. The point isn't you're trying to get God concerned because God's really not concerned. The point is you're trying to connect to the deepest mercies and love and compassion of God that's already there prior to you having it. Sometimes I think some ways that people speak of prayer, you'd almost think that they're doing their best to make sure God's as concerned as they are. And trust me, our concern is infinitesimally small compared to the love and the grace and concern of God. That we don't have to muster up God's concern. It's already there. What we have to learn is to rest in it. We have to learn to know that God already knows all that I need. So I need to learn to grow closer in dependence, in trust, and pray to God. Trusting my soul to God. Trusting my case to God. Jesus, in his final words, into your hands I commend my spirit on the cross in the instance of the greatest injustice we can fathom. And he says, you know what? You care. I entrust myself to you. So you have this deep, deep devotion and prayer that Christ is inviting us to have, to know that we don't have to work ourselves into a frenzy to get God to care at all. That we can actually approach a God who is so committed to us, like a good mother, this God can end our sentences for us. You know, if I just simply say, help, that's pretty much all I need to say. And my mom used to know me so well, she'd know exactly what the problem was. Multiply that by infinity, and that's what he's trying to get across. This is why his Abba spirituality, the spirituality of resting in the Father, was so central and crucial to Jesus' way of understanding. And he's trying to get his followers to enter into that. To enter into that Abba spirituality. And the way he does is with what we call our model prayer, the Lord's Prayer, so that he gives them a model by which to pray. And the first words are, our Abba. Our Father, close, intimate, protective, guarding, guiding, loving, tending, and yet in heaven. So close, yet distant. And I love that tension. You have that deep, intimate closeness, father, mother, being held in the intimate embrace of God. And yet this is a God who is truly God, a God beyond fathoming, in heaven. And because of that, the only word to speak of a transcendent God like that is, hallowed be your name. And then the first request, which is so important because this whole sermon is on how to live the gospel of the kingdom, the first request that ought to be on our lips if we follow the model prayer should always be, "Your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." So the desire is to bring the heavenly reign into our earthly lives. The goal of this prayer isn't, "I get to go to heaven when I die." The goal is, "I want to bring heaven to earth by inviting the living God into my life in such a way that the reign of that God becomes the central desire of my will. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." So central that a lot of concerns and cares that might overwhelm me aren't there on the surface all the time, because I'm not worried about tomorrow or next week or next month or next year, because what matters is, give us this day our daily bread. I think that's so vital. I could spend a lot of time on that. Jesus, by the time this chapter ends, he will say, "Give no thought for tomorrow will worry about itself. Every day has enough trouble of its own." And I think there's a lot of areas in life I know that I need to wrestle with that. I think there's a lot of areas in life we as a church community need to wrestle with. We seem to live in the future in worry, or in the past with regret, instead of realizing Jesus is honest. Today has troubles, but God's only here today. So give us this day what? More than we need? No, just what we need, our daily bread. And then in light of that, you then have this call that we would become a certain kind of person. First, in awareness, we always fall short. Forgive us our debts. Jesus is very aware that whatever he's calling us to as his disciples, we will fail regularly, daily. Every day we'll fail. So much so that we'll have to say every day, "Forgive me this day, just as you're giving me my daily bread, forgive me my sins, for I have sinned and fallen short of the fullness of the greater righteousness you've called me to. I have fallen short once again." And being aware of how desperately I need that constant forgiveness, make me a person who forgives others. Because how horrible it would be for us to graciously and widely receive God's abundant forgiveness and then deny that to others. I mean, that just simply is a mixed message altogether. That I deserve forgiveness, but you know, for that little thing you did to me, you don't deserve a bit. And all of a sudden we realize Christ is trying to get us every day to focus on being more merciful like the Father in heaven. The Father causes the rain to come on the righteous and the unrighteous. There's a mercy there. There's a forgiveness there. So we then move on. "Lead us not into temptation," which is to say every day there are going to be challenges. There are things that we're going to have to wrestle with. We want to make sure that God's with us and that we're aware of all the challenges to our faith and hope and love, and that we're inviting God to be the one who empowers us to resist and to fight and to strive against that, so that we can be delivered from the powers of the evil one. Because Jesus is quite aware that as we live this kingdom life, that we are going to be fighting the darkness, particularly if we devote ourselves to this: "Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness." The idea from the beginning that if you do right, the powers that be, the powers of this world, the cultural ways of approaching life that are dominant and vocal and speak of strength and violence, they will seek to still your voice. They will seek to make sure that you as a troublemaker aren't, you know, given enough room to speak. And Jesus, of course, is the model of that again. That the powers that be, both the religious and political power, saw him as enough of a threat that they put him on a Roman execution stake and said, "This one must be eliminated." So we have all of these wonderful things in this prayer, and it's a great prayer not only to learn by heart and to pray regularly. Obviously it can be prayed rotely and we can miss out on it, but if we pray it and learn it and memorize it, it's always a tool for us to come back to, because the point of it is to allow it to guide our own intercessions so that we always know that the gateway into prayer is our Abba. That's the gateway. The gateway isn't God who's distant, but your Father knows what you need before you ask, and therefore pray, "Our Abba, and yet holy, your kingdom, your will, Help me today. Today's got enough troubles of its own. Make me merciful and forgiving. Strengthen me in the midst of the darkness that surrounds me and that is even within me, so that I won't give in, but I that will maintain a witness of light in this world. And you begin to see how wonderful that prayer is. Now, it's interesting, as you come to the end of this, the only part of the prayer that Jesus comments on is the part about forgiveness, which suggests that the thing he's concerned that his original hearers get is that this prayer is intended to make them merciful. It's intended to cause them to grow in the things that the Beatitudes spoke of. Blessed are the merciful. They shall be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, and blessed are the peacemakers. And that if we miss out on mercy, integrity, and peacemaking, we've missed the whole point. So he wants to make sure that we're committed to those things and that we aren't just rotely even praying, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Which then leads us to the last one, fasting. In Jesus' culture, the people would fast at different times. They'd fast during national crises. They'd fast during times of repentance and renewal. They would fast personally just to show humility. Every single person would fast at least once a year during Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Now, fasting has different shapes and sizes. We often think of fasting as a whole day, but for many in that ancient culture, it meant from sun up to sun down. So you took that, but you'd have maybe a nice breakfast and you'd have a good dinner. So you're kind of fasting during a lunch hour. So that it's not always as large as it sometimes seems to us. But Jesus assumes that there will be some kind of fasting. And if not fasting, and I know some because of dietary reasons can't do it, self-denial. Some form or shape of denying oneself in order to make room for God. So that's what we're talking about here. So when you fast, verse 16, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces. Why? To show men their fasting. So again, they're making a good show. The performance is on a high level so that people can see how miserable they are in their spirituality. Just they're miserable. They love God so much they're willing to be miserable. And he says, I tell you the truth, they've got it. I mean, the performance receives 5 stars, thumbs up. People see it. They say, boy, that person's spiritual. That person's really religious. But they're not doing it for the right reasons. So verse 17, he says, when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, so that it will not be obvious to men that you're fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. So do it for God. God's the one who's standing close by you in this discipline. God is the one you're seeking. God is the one that will reward you with a deeper knowledge and awareness of God. So there's a payoff in all of these, but there's a twofold payoff. The payoff, if these practices are done to be seen by others, is there's a success. They pay off. Others see. The person grows in a spiritual community in a position of prestige and prominence and perhaps even power because, hey, you know, let's listen to this guy because look how spiritual he is. But if the payoff is what it ought to be, because almsgiving and prayer and fasting are supposed to be about renewing and restoring your relationship with God, growing closer in knowledge of God, coming to be more merciful, more obedient to the Father's will, more aware of the Father's goodness, all of those things, then you begin to see that the payoff is there if we understand that we're doing these things first and foremost for an audience of one, which is why we called the message tonight an audience of one. Now, before I give just a couple of quick notes, it's important to see what is for some not a contradiction, but at least a conundrum, and that is they wrestle with, well, how do you connect what we've looked at here with Matthew 5:16? Because this is a sermon, and Jesus at the beginning of this sermon said in Matthew 5:16, in the same way, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. You hopefully see at least the possible conundrum. Let your light shine before men so they may see your good works and praise your Father in heaven. And then in chapter 6, verse 1, be careful not to do acts of righteousness before men in order to be seen by them. And that can become quite a challenge. And I think it's a simple answer, but it demands just a little bit of thinking. The works that are seen, that are salt and light, are public works. Works that we had seen at the end of chapter 5, where we are talking about issues of relationships, divorce, oaths, justice, love for enemies, anger and murder, lust and adultery. These are all social behaviors that Christ is inviting us to live the greater righteousness in. And when we live those behaviors, it's going to have a positive social influence. It's going to bring salt and light to a very dark place. But there are other types of actions that are meant to be more interior. They're not public actions. The great spiritual people would say that there's the exterior life and the interior life. And Matthew 5:16 is about the exterior life, living your faith in a public setting, living it in spite of how you may even perhaps be persecuted for doing what you feel is the way of the Christ. But then there are the interior works which are meant to be done in secret. The very purpose of almsgiving is to help others, and that's how you're being a salt and light, but it's not by getting all the applause because you're such a generous person. That's self-endorsing. That's self-promoting. The very purpose of prayer is to connect with God and grow in intimacy with God, not for people to say, what an amazing prayer you are. So that's what I see is going on here, and that all of these three disciplines here are meant to be more interior. They're meant to be more committed to the reward of growing in knowledge of God. Which then leads to this, and this is what's important about this passage. I haven't used this word one time yet, but in all three of these cases, alms, prayer, and fasting, Jesus used this word. Because you can summarize what he's warning us against in one word. And that's the word hypocrite. In every one of these, verse 2, for example, when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do. Verse 5, when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites. Verse 16, when you fast, do not be look somber as the hypocrites do. So that he has summarized this in one word, and the Greek word behind hypocrisy really just means play acting. Performing a role in order to be seen by others. It's not even necessarily on its own a negative term, because it has innately to do with Greek and Roman play acting. You'd have a bunch of men. I don't think women were allowed to do this in the day in the Greco-Roman society, but the men, in order to play parts, would put on a mask. And while they were performing their part, they'd have their mask over. And then if they had to do another part, they'd put another mask over. And the way you did special effects in those days, if you will, is you put a mask over your face and then you became that character. But we all know that putting a mask over your face doesn't make you that character. George Clooney played a doctor in an emergency room. I'd never trust him to be a doctor in my emergency room. Chris Hemsworth plays Thor. But he's not Thor. I mean, you could go on down the line with everyone we know that does this art of acting, and you realize that it is a performance. And when the performance is done, you take off the makeup, the lights go down, the cameras stop rolling, and you go back to being who you were. How devastating would it be if our religious life were reduced to putting on the mask and becoming a performance so that others are impressed and others could see how deeply spiritual we were. And then when we were done, we cast the mask aside and went on about our dreary way. Went on about things without a thought for the God who sees in secret. The God who's constantly there for us, that wants to be known by us, that wants to grow in relationship with us. We would see that as a devastating reality. We would see that all of these performances were sad and tragic. What's even worse is if the person has worn the mask so long, they're not even aware they're wearing it any longer. That the performance has become so much a part of them that there's no cognizance that there's a total disconnect between the performance and what one really desires. So Jesus is out for hypocrisy, and he's out for it because it's something that we all have to wrestle with. It's something that it's not just, you know, they do it, but we never will. He warns us because it's something we need warning of. His followers need to know this is the bad place, the dark place that religion can go to. And so when we think of hypocrisy, one of the greatest tragedies of it is it just squeezes God out because everything is done for self-promotion. Everything is done in such a way that the performer is only preoccupied with his or herself and not really with God. They're not even aware that the God who's in secret and who sees in secret is the audience that they really should be performing for. But instead they're looking past that audience of one to an audience that really isn't meant to be the audience to these performances. This, in the end, ends up trivializing God, and that's why Jesus will again and again use that phrase, you know, don't ever trivialize God. God is so wonderful and so big and so much a part of your life that everywhere you go, God in secret is there. Your Father who you do not see sees you in secret. He uses that phrase 3 times. And the idea is just to remind us that God really does long for this closeness, this tender relationship, this Abba spirituality between Father and Son and Mother and Daughter, this deep, deep commitment, so that we need to be aware of that so that we don't trivialize the actions of prayer and giving and fasting. T.S. Eliot put it like this, "The last temptation is the greatest treason to do the right deed for the wrong reason." I just like that. That's just a great phrase. I don't know which poem that is from, but one of you people who read a lot of T.S. Eliot, I just pull out little phrases of his and enjoy them. I really can't read poetry on my own. It's just, I can't slow down that much. Which leads to this, and I rarely do this, but I'm going to do this. The most shocking truth of chapter 6 to me, when we really think about what it's saying, is that if we're not careful, God can get squeezed out of religion, even in the very act of being religious. Because that's what's going on in chapter 6. God is squeezed out altogether in the very act that are meant to lead to a deeper knowledge of God. Which is why I'd like to advocate in my closing thoughts that religion ought to come with one of these. It ought to come with a warning label. You know what a warning label is? It's a label attached to an item or contained in an item's instruction manual that warns the user about the risks associated with the use of the item as intended by the manufacturer or seller. The reason it ought to be, I would dare say most people in our culture would be just fine hearing, oh, you pray. Well, gosh, you must be religious. You give. Well, you must be generous. You fast. Oh, gosh, you must be committed. And what Jesus is saying, none of those things on their own are indications that you're in any way connecting with God. You may be doing a good thing or the right thing, but it's not for the right reason, and thus you're getting a wrong reward for it. You're getting a pale reward in light of what the real reward ought to be. So that we have warning symbols. One of the silliest ones, but you know, if you don't know coffee's hot by now, on the outside of coffee cups, caution, I'm hot. We have these on medicine labels all the time, and rightly so. Many need a certain medicine, but they need to know that there are side effects, and they need to know there's a warning to taking it. The medicine, just like the actions of prayer and almsgiving and fasting, that medicine may be good, but they might get kind of the wrong consequence of it if they don't heed to the warning, like this medicine may cause drowsiness and may increase the effects of alcohol. If affected, do not drive a motor vehicle or operate machinery. Why? For your own good and for the good of others. Which is why I think religion probably ought to come with this warning. Warning. Religious practices could be hazardous to one's spiritual health. And yet that's not how we tend to think. We don't tend to go there because we kind of assume if we're just even making an attempt at these things that that's probably good enough. But the challenge Jesus offers in light of the fuller righteousness is not only that we should be doing these things, but we need to think about why we do them and how we do them and who we're seeking impress. That's exactly the word I'm looking for. Thank you. Whose applause it is that we're yearning for there. And the challenge for all of us is to realize the applause that we should desire, first and foremost, above all, is the only applause that counts. You know, this is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased. Everyone was against Jesus except for just a small smattering of women at the cross. And the Father looks upon this, I'm well pleased. So that we must realize that there's only one applause that really matters. And that then challenges us to make sure that in all we do, we make sure that we are not, as Paul will put it, man-pleasers. That others' applause and approval isn't our goal, that we're not doing things like we read here, to be praised by others, seen by others, to show others. And we all have to wrestle with it, some of us worse than others, because all of us have a little bit of an approval junkie in us. It's a strong temptation. We want to be accepted. We want to be appreciated. We want to have a certain amount of prestige and prominence. We want to be able to, in the circles we run in, be the kind of people that people look up to. And there's, I guess, nothing wrong with that. But the bigger challenge is that we remember there are certain things that aren't meant to do that, almsgiving, prayer, fasting being three of those, so that we're looking for the applause of one. And I can tell you, you're making progress in this. If you can do good, do a good action, commit yourself to prayer, give, and not be recognized at all for it. So if you have to be recognized every time you serve, every time you give, every time you deny yourself, that kind of is a meter to show how far you are from this. But if you can do those things without recognition, without applause. Now, it's nice to get that. I'm not saying we ought to be the kind of community like God that says, oh yeah, we ought to be the kind constantly lifting up people and saying, good job and wonderful and we're behind you and we're praying for you. But if that's the only reason we're doing it, then we may be doing it for the wrong reasons, even though we may be doing the right thing. Now, I want to close by simply saying this. This is true. When you hear this, don't be thinking two things. Don't be thinking they're the hypocrites and I don't have any problem with this. And also don't be thinking, man, I'm such a hypocrite and everyone else must not wrestle with this. Because that's not the point. The warning's given to Christ's disciples because we're the ones who need it. And we will fall and fail. And if we never ever give or pray or fast until we think we can do it with the most sincere motivations and for all the right reasons, we'll never do it. We have to do it recognizing that it's a good thing in and of itself, but our constant challenge, since God wants our heart and longs for us to grow close to God, to be people of salt and light, not just in our social practices, but in our interior life, that as we do those things, we're constantly wrestling with, am I growing closer to God? Am I doing this for the right reason? Whose applause am I seeking? Who do I want to impress? And as we see that hypocritical mask rise up every now and then, the best thing we'll learn to do is to strip it off. And to say, yeah, that's not right. That prayer was a bit flowery to impress that person. This giving was a little bit too outrageous in the sense that I wanted to make sure this person and this person knew I was doing this. So that we just kind of begin to grow closer to understanding when it is we're beginning to lift that mask off up, knowing that we do have the possibility of pushing it down again, knowing that what God longs for more than anything else is for the Father who sees us in secret, for us to respond in love and say, I'm doing this for you, and I love you, and I long for your applause. And when we can live like that, then we're really set to do good works in this world, regardless of how people respond. We're ready to do good works in the way of the Christ who denies himself when nobody else is applauding it, when nobody else is giving him any credit or seeing anything right, and he sticks to it.